All players, low down, active, bullseye, 1, 3, 2, 7, put tactical.
Welcome to The Merge, where we make sense of the defense in an enjoyable way. You're in the right place if you want to track military tech trends and happenings. It's for insiders, by insiders. And welcome to the first pod of 2024. We're going to start it off with a bang, literally. Before we get to that, I do plan on keep The Merge going and growing, but I need some help. And so if you're on Apple, give us a rating and a review. 5 stars or bust. Same goes with Spotify. If you're on YouTube, like, subscribe, and drop us a comment. It feeds the algorithm, helps it spread it to more people, and we really do appreciate it. And finally, this wouldn't be possible if it were not for the newsletter. So subscribe to the newsletter. The link's in the show notes. Share it with someone who you want to get smarter, and then along the way, you can earn some merch. Okay, motherhood is complete. Before we get started with today's guest, a quick intro about control of the air. So air superiority, a lot of our listeners are familiar with that. Air superiority is a degree of control that permits ops without prohibitive interference. That's the definition. There's a smart old guy named John Warden. He was an air power theorist from Desert Storm. He architected that. There's a 5-ring system model he used for centers of gravity. And his conclusion of his air power research was that since 1939, quote, no country has won a war in the face of enemy air superiority. No major offense has succeeded against an opponent who controlled the air, and no defense has sustained itself against an enemy who had air superiority. Air superiority has consistently been a prelude to military victory. So that's John Warden. So we think about air superiority, we like to think about fancy fighters and shooting missiles and dogfighting and things like that, but it's not just about offensive capabilities, it's about defensive tools too. So control of the air, you've seen it playing out for the past 2 years, specifically in Ukraine, but it's not the airplanes that are making the difference. It's the air defenses on both sides, by the way. And so air defenses is what we're going to talk about today. In my experience in the U.S. military, it's something that we took our eye off the prize for a generation, thanks to permissive air operations in the Middle East and budget cuts to support those. But it's a very interesting air defense system we're going to talk about today. It's been humming along the whole time. Most people, if it was not for Ukraine, have never heard of it. And maybe you've never heard of it still. But today, as we're recording this, it is not only protecting troops in Ukraine, it's protecting the White House. So our guest to help tell that story today, we went right to the source. Our guest is Joe D'Antonia. He is the Vice President of Land and Air Defense Systems at Raytheon. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Joe, before we get started and why we have Joe on the show, if you notice, he works for Raytheon. They are the people who build the system, so he is the expert, and he does have some experience in the field. He's not just someone in corporate industry selling some tech. So, Joe, tell us a little bit about your background. You were a West Point guy to start with, right?
I am. Yes, Mike. I graduated from West Point in 1984. I was commissioned into the Air Defense Artillery in the U.S. Army. And then for the next 30 years, I served as an air and missile defender in the United States Army with extensive time in Europe, Middle East, and also in the Asia Pacific region. So I like to think that my second career in Raytheon was really just somewhat of an extension of my passion for ground-based air defense, just on from a different perspective, if you will. And it's been a real enjoyable career. I've been with Raytheon for almost 9 years now.
Awesome. And your portfolio, the way you describe it, it's more than just NASAMS. Obviously, it's a lot of there. You have a lot of ground-based air defenses, whether it's effectors, launchers, radars, and we're going to get into some of those components today. But really, our focus today is going to be on those components as part of NASAMS. So let's start at the beginning. I've said the word NASAMS 2 or 3 times already. Can you just tell us what is the acronym stand for, and then what are the components, and we'll kind of go from the origin story from that.
Sure, sure. So NASAM stands for National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile. Previously, NASAMs had a different definition or a different description. It used to be called the Norwegian Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile because the Norwegians were the first country to put together what we know today as being the modern-day NASAM solution. Over the course of time, Raytheon, in conjunction with our partners Kongsberg Defense out of Norway, took NASAMs globally. And as a result of that, there was probably a need to acknowledge the larger family of users. And so we changed the N from Norwegian to national. Ever since the 13 nations that subscribe to NASAMs as a key component of their ground-based air defense are part of this national advanced surface-to-air missile community.
Now, the claim to fame from NASAMs, and one of the many reasons that why I wanted to pick this to start 2024 off, is its claim to fame is the world's first operational network-centric short or medium-range ground-based air defense system. So there's a whole bunch to unpack there.
Yeah.
The origin stories, I'm glad you brought up the Norwegian part with Kongsberg, because Raytheon and Kongsberg have had a relationship that goes way, way, way back. This is probably, 30 or 40 years, right?
It is. It's greater than 30 years of a close partnership between Raytheon and Kongsberg in a host of different kind of capabilities within the defense community. But arguably, the most important partnership we have and the one that's becoming the most recognized is our partnership with NASAMS.
And one of the things that, and here's the spin on this whole show. You think, hey, it's a missile defense system. You got some missiles. We're going to shoot it from the ground to the air. There's some kind of radar. You're going to guide it. There's some kind of command and control node. But here is the spin. NASAMS shoots air-to-air missiles. That is a key part of its product, is it is reusing air-to-air missiles and shooting them from the ground. And when you think about the AIM 120, which is the staple beyond visual range missile, also a Raytheon product, by the way, that was developed 30 years ago. And almost since the time it was fielded as a air-to-air missile, it was adapted to NASAMS, the first generation of NASAMS. So ground-launched AIM 120 missiles have been a part of this program since the mid-1990s, which is one of those things that you would never have imagined that if you didn't know the history of backtracking NASAMS, of how far back this concept goes of adapting air-to-air missiles into ground-based air defense systems.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you go out into the international market space and you start looking at, you know, who's competing and who is developing capabilities in this mission set, the solutions, the components that Raytheon and Kongsberg have brought together to comprise NASAMS are world-class in their own right. And so imagine taking components that are world-class capabilities by themselves, pulling them together, integrating them, and then providing that as a solution to the customer. I don't think you can find a solution in that mission space that has even close to 13 global customers that all came to the same conclusion.
Yeah, when you look at from just the effector side, and we'll talk more about the other components, but from the effector side, if you have an Air Force and they already have air-to-air missiles, and you can use with no changes, put those missiles and field them in an air defense system, your supply chain, economies of scale, just the training and interoperability that you have, it's just inherent to your military, is just a huge force multiplier, I'd imagine, right?
Well, it is. And, you know, and if you put a warfighter hat on, put on a warfighting commander's hat on, and the commander knows that that AMRAAM missile is critically important to the defense or the use of whatever it is that he or she is responsible for. And now they have a solution that does not require them to put aircraft in the sky 24/7. You know how stressing it is to keep air sorties in the sky 24/7 to do a mission? And yet with a surface launched capability, you've now removed that burden and you have provided the commander with a no kidding 24/7 all weather protection using that missile set, if in fact you are an owner of the NASAM solution. So there's, to your point, there's a lot of value, not only economic value, because there's literally no difference between the AMRAAM missile that you slap on a fighter aircraft wing and the AMRAAM missile that you would put into the NASAMS solution. It is literally the same exact missile. So you have economies, as you had mentioned, but you also now provide an extended, dependable capability of a missile for a commander without having to exhaust or to put very valuable fighter aircraft in the skies running sorties 24/7.
Yeah, there's a few, and I do know the pain of being in the air endlessly, hours at a time, doing that mission. So yes, I do have an idea. It hurts. It hurts a lot.
It does.
But nothing's free, and we'll get to some of these trade-offs later.
Sure.
As a rule of thumb that I think of, three seems to be like a weird number that somehow fits most cases. So if I take a bomb and I put a wing kit on it, I get about triple the range out of it. If I take an air-to-air missile and launch it from the ground, whatever those specifications are, I kind of cut it by a third, so divide by three, and that's kind of the range that you get out of it-ish, you know, not to get into the specifics.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You're absolutely right. You know, the origin of the launch has a lot to do with, you know, the ranges and a lot of the other metrics and measurements that you would use for a missile. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and we'll get into that just a little bit, because I think that, you know, that trade-off, I think, is somewhat offset by the fact that it's a network-centric system, which makes it very, very unique. We'll get to that in a minute. Real quick, there's a few different generations of NASAMs, if you could put them in the buckets. There was the first generation in the 90s that we talked about with the 120. There was a, right after 9/11, there was another generation. I think it used a data link of some type. And then more recently, there's a Gen 3, I think, NASAMs. And I'd like to pick on that.
Sure.
Between 2 and 3.
Sure.
Because from the U.S. perspective, there's a lot of false starts and things that have happened about that same time frame that you might be wondering, where is all the NASAMs in the U.S. military?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, a little bit of a history lesson, if you will. Coming out of, you know, the 90s, where tactical ballistic missiles became the threat of choice that ground-based air defense was focused on. And I think, you know, from the early 90s in Desert Storm all the way through, you know, the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003, TBMs were what everybody was concerned about. And in large part because there was a belief that that would be the vehicle by which weapons of mass destructions would be launched onto allied forces and or critical assets. So there was a fixation on TBMs in the 90s.
That's
and the
tactical
early
tactical ballistic missiles.
Yes.
So SCUDs.
You betcha.
For short, being one version of
that's
SCUDs.
Exactly right. What we started to see in the early 2000s was the growth and the capability of cruise missiles. Now, across this decade, fighter aircraft, rotary wing aircraft, all of those were still very consistent in the airspace. So I'm not discounting rotary and fighter wing, but what I wanted to articulate a little bit is we kind of had the V8 moment in the early 2000s. In the late 90s and the early 2000s, that cruise missiles were starting to be proliferated throughout the international community. And you know, the flight profiles for cruise missiles are a lot different than you would have for either tactical ballistic missiles, TBMs, and or rotary and fighter wing aircraft. So there became this need and this interest to have to expand ground-based air defense to be able to solve this problem. And in fact, in the U.S. Army, we were, I was on active duty at the time, but you know, we were knee deep into this because as air and missile defenders, that was part of our mission set. And you may not recall, but there was a program in the U.S. Army called SLAMRAM, which was surface-launched AMRAAM. And it was meant to be the medium-ranged air defense system that was going to finally replace the Hawk missile system that had been retired years beforehand, but also be the solution that would address this cruise missile threat for commanders, you know, in the next battle space, if you will. And the development for SLAMRAM, conceptually, same thing, surface-launched AMRAAM, right? So the AIM-120 missile was kind of the centerpiece of this ground-based air defense solution. And then this thing came along, which was the insurgency and the counterinsurgency mindset, if you will, and the long war that the U.S. found itself in. And so some programs that were specifically designed for that high intensity conflict approach kind of got put on the side in order to address the near term threat that the U.S. was facing at the time. And that's kind of what happened to SLAMRAM. You know, so there was an acknowledgement of the threat many, many years ago, and there was a path towards success that was going there, but it just fell to the, you know, to the needs of the country, if you will, to address the insurgency and subsequently the counterinsurgency that the U.S. found itself in for the next 15 years. NASAMS was essentially already developed and it was already working. And so when 9/11 occurred, as you mentioned, you know, say the White House, you know, I would say that the asset is actually a little bit broader than the White House. We call it the National Capital Region. What we realized was that, in fact, we were vulnerable to low-flying and cruise missile-like capabilities. And so that opened the door for the U.S. to look broadly, because SLAMRAM just wasn't ready or available at that point. And NASAMS was introduced into the U.S. military and, you know, in the post-9/11 era has been operating in the National Capital Region 24/7. So, I mean, we're going on, you know, almost two decades now of defense of the airspace over the National Capital Region.
Yeah, you'd think it was amazing that, you know, you think about it now, I was like, wait, why were there no air defenses around the National Capital Region? You know, but back then, like, that wasn't, no one really thought of it. Yeah. So when 9/11 happened, you go back, for those of you who remember, it was alert launching fighters to go intercept and patrol the skies. And some of these alert launches didn't even have missiles loaded because, like, just get an aircraft in the air, we'll figure it out later. Well, what do you want me to do with no missiles? So there's a couple stories about, well, I guess we'll just ram these jets if we need to. But there was no air defense systems, which was, looking back, you're like, oh, that was not a good idea. Obviously, history, you know, hindsight 2020. When you said the SLAMRAM, that was based off of the high mobility launcher. Yeah. Which is basically you put this rail launch system. So there weren't canisters, they were just rails. Right. They were basically in the back of a Humvee. Like an open-aired Humvee. And so that's where the SLAMRAM came from. That was very, very, very similar to another project called CLAWS. The Marine Corps had that. Yep. The Complementary Low Altitude Weapon System. It was basically the same thing.
That's right.
Maybe slightly different. The rail might have been different. But it was the same concept. It was AIM-9 Mikes and AIM-120s, both of these projects. And the Marine Corps canceled theirs in 2006 as they get pulled into Iraq. And then the Army tried to hold on as long as they could, and they canceled that basically at the surge in Afghanistan. So 2010, 2011, they said, we got to trade money for this. Yeah. We can't support it. Acknowledge that there's going to be a capability gap. But at the time, this is also the time that, like, the F-22 program got cut, the Secretary of the Air Force got fired, and it was, you have to be all in on the Middle East or else. Yeah. And so these were trade-offs that were made. And you can see, you know, looking back, you're like, hey, that probably wasn't a good idea. And turns out, if you're an Air Force guy listening to this and you think, just buy more air defenses, why does this matter? The Air Force does not have the mission of protecting its air bases. That is an Army mission. So you really need to care about what matters, what the Army is doing with their force structure, because you're going to reap those benefits and those protections. That is a nuance that a lot of people don't realize. You know, you have an air base, you have a wing commander on an air base, but he's not in charge of defending the air base from attack and coordinating it. That's a huge nuance between the Army and the Air Force that just wanted to highlight.
You know, Mike, to your point, you know, I served 30 years as an air and missile defender. All of my deployments were in defense of U.S. Air Force and in one case, U.S. naval assets. So even though I wore the U.S. Army, you know, patches, the truth of the matter is, to your point, the U.S. Army was responsible to the Air Force and to the Navy for ground-based air defense solutions. And that's what I did my entire career, whether it was Desert Shield, Desert Storm, Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, you name it. I was, you know, generally the units that I was assigned to were responsible for protecting critical joint assets. And in that regard, mostly Air Force, and in a couple of occasions, naval assets. So you hit the nail right on the head there. It is an Army responsibility to provide that GBAD, that ground-based air defense capability, to the joint force.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit and we said, you know, NASAMS, there's an S at the end. Mm-hmm. It's not NASAM, mm-hmm. it's NASAMS because it's a system. Yeah. So, Joe, can you break down what are the key, there's three or four, sure. I think, key elements of the system that kind of make it all work together?
Sure.
How's it all work?
I mean, if you think about ground-based air defense in general, you know, it's a three-legged stool. You have to have first and foremost, you have to have something to be able to see the threat. So you have to have a sensor or a radar, you know, as part of your solution set, if you will. And for the NASAM system, the cornerstone of the sensor solution is the Sentinel radar. Again, a product that Raytheon produces. It is a program of record within the U.S. Army. The U.S. Army has hundreds of Sentinel radars scattered throughout the battle space. The second component that you have to have is a command and control system. And interestingly enough, in the partnership that we have with Kongsberg, manufactures and produces what we call the Fire Direction Center, the FDC. And to your point, Mike, this is an open architecture C2 solution that allows the customer flexibility to incorporate NASAMS into a larger architecture or to make NASAMS the cornerstone of the architecture with which they're going to build so that it can integrate other components as needed to create a more holistic solution for whatever it is they're doing.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense because I was doing the research. If you Google NASAMS, you can either go to Raytheon's website that has NASAMS or you'll end up at Kongsberg's website that has NASAMS. And the difference, there's a little bit of nuance. And so because Kongsberg produces the fire distribution center and because it's that open architecture, they actually have more countries, the number of countries that use NASAMS and the number of countries that use their fire distribution center is not the same number. Right. They actually have more, they have 16, I think, nations that actually use their FDC, 13 of which are also using it with integrating with the NASAMS. So it took me for a minute to try to sort out what those actually meant. But thanks for clarifying. That makes a whole lot more sense.
No, you bet. And you know, the nice thing about Kongsberg is Kongsberg was doing this way before anybody else was. So they have years and years of experience in knowing how to bring this kind of solution, if you will, to the customer. And they have been advancing it similar to the way Raytheon has been advancing their products in a way that really make, you know, NASAMS, you know, a special capability, if you will. So you got the Kongsberg FDC, you got the Raytheon sensor. Now you get to two other components, but they're all interchangeable, and that is the launcher and the missiles that go in the launcher. The launchers, we offer two. The canister launcher, which you referred to earlier, is made by Kongsberg. It is mobile. It is also used for a lot of static defense capabilities, like protecting air bases where you're not going to move as much. And then the high mobility launcher that we developed under SLAMRAM is another option that a customer could use if he or she wants to have, you know, more mobility, maneuverability, if you will, with their NASAM solution. So customers have a choice of a canister launcher that is, you know, downloaded and it's put onto hydraulics and lifted and raised, or they can have the Humvee version of the high mobility launcher, which we call HML, to load up their missiles. And then the third or the fourth and the last component are the missiles themselves. And again, here's, I think, a unique part of the NASAM solution. To your point, the bread and butter, the cornerstone of the missiles has always been the AMRAAM missile, a superb missile, first in its class for a long, long period of time and continues to be so today. But what we found,
I've shot many of them. They're good missiles.
They are. I mean, you know, it's amazing in how the AMRAAM missile has progressed over the years as well. You know, everybody, when they hear about a missile that might be a couple of decades old, they immediately think nothing's changed to that missile. And I kind of remind people, it's like a car. You know, it's like the 69 Mustang and the 2023 Mustang are very different cars. They're Mustangs, but they're very different cars. Missiles and radars and, you know, are the same way. You may call them the same thing in large part because, frankly, their name is recognized. But what they are and how they are, you know, what they can do are much different than maybe what you remember from years ago, if you will.
Yeah. And to your point, though, just to take it one more step, because the military acquisitions is just really weird with contracting. There's AIM-120 and then you have ABCD. And then you have C5, C6, C7, C8. The 120, the newest version, the 120D3, I believe is the connotation. That actually should have been a completely different variant. So an E or an F model. Right. But I worked in one of the units, we're doing the test. Like, this is a completely, like, everything is new in this missile. The logic is different. Everything about it is different. But because of the way the contract was written, it had to be a form fit upgrade to the 120D. And so it had to maintain the D designation to it.
You've done your research.
Yeah, I lived it. I was like, we just rename it, because when we went around and you start giving the academics and people, like, the operators are like, none of this is the same. Why? Like, I don't, it's just a mental thing. Because it says 120D. I'm expecting to see, like, what are the couple changes that you've made? Not like this is a completely new weapon. Like, you better fence in for a few hours of learning.
Right.
Because everything of how you employ it is going to change. Like, oh, like, I didn't know that. I'm like, yeah, well, thank, you know, the acquisition attorneys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're right about that. But, you know, so again, so you got the AIM-120. The thing that we started to realize as our customer base started to grow was NASAMS was being used in a multi-dimensional manner, if you will. And so the need for multiple missiles based on the threats that the customer was using NASAMS for became inherent. In other words, you could use the same arrow every time, but there were more efficient, effective ways that we might be able to bring to the customer to make NASAMS even more valuable. And over the course, this gets to your version 3 of NASAMS, if you will, over the course of the last several years, we have invested and we are now distributing NASAMS capabilities that has 3 missiles, the base AIM-120 AMRAAM. We have an extended ranged AMRAAM, which we call AMRAAM-ER, which is being developed right now and being tested and performing very well. As you can imagine, it gives extended range from the traditional AMRAAM missile because some of our NASAMS customers wanted to be able to engage their threats at a distance that was that exceeded the current AMRAAM capability.
Trying to get some of that range back that you lose from putting it on the ground. And the pictures of it, so AMRAAM ER, basically if you think of, like, if you cut the missile in half, the front half of the missile looks like a AIM-120. Yep. And then the back half of the missile is wider, and so it has a larger booster. Is that from an AIM-7 program?
Actually, yeah. So it was there was a couple of backends that we started with. You know, we started with the ESSM backend early on. We're now working with a company, NAMO, in Norway to develop the backend for the new AMRAAM-ER missile set, which, to your point, you know, what we're doing is we're trying to find the newest technologies, whether that's fuels, you know, capacities, weight, as you know, is a very important part of this, and infuse that into the solution set, if you will. But essentially, it is the back end of an existing capability with the front end of the AMRAAM that you know. Unfortunately, it's just not as simple as putting those two things together like a Lego.
Yeah, the engineers are going to, you know, science the shit out of it.
Oh, you betcha they will.
Matt Damon.
Absolutely. But then again, so and then the third part of this was, you know, an interest and a need for another solution set, which the AIM-9X missile became, the clear kind of solution, if you will, to those particular threats. And so we have integrated, and again, AIM-9X is a missile made by Raytheon. So we have integrated the AIM-9X into NASAMS. So now a customer who purchases a NASAMS or upgrades their current NASAMS has the ability to procure and to use 3 different missiles based on how they intend to employ their NASAMS solution with the same capability.
And all 3 fit in the same launch tube.
Off the same launch tube. That's the key, right? I mean, you don't want to create, you know, more logistics, more challenging, more training solutions. You want to keep this all condensed. And of course, then you have to have, you know, a computer system that will be able to help the operator make the right decision in terms, you know, when you only had one missile, there wasn't a lot of decision, you fired. Now you have 2 or 3 missiles. The computer facilitates the threat for the missile type, makes the recommendation to the operator. The operator can override if, in fact, that's the decision that they want to make. But it's an assistance to allow us to put the right effector on the right threat target in seconds, which, you know, is, you know, kind of how that mission space operates. It operates in seconds. It doesn't operate in minutes or days or weeks. It operates in seconds and in some kind, sometimes milliseconds, if you will. So a lot of expansion on the effector side. Going back, if I could, Mike, to the first piece I talked about, which was the sensor.
Again, hold on just a minute before we jump to that, because I do want to talk about the sensor stuff, because that's really, really fascinating what you guys are doing. So here the logic train, if there's listeners out there, especially the fighter pilots that are listening, like, hey, so we have this aim. So these ground-based air defense missiles that we're talking about are relatively tiny, yeah, right? Because they're adapted from fighters. So we have this canister that has a common system. So any of these three missiles will fit in this canister. If the canister was originally designed to fit an AIM-120, now we have this 120ER, the extended range AMRAAM. The next logical question every fighter pilot would probably has is, does that mean eventually I can put it on an AMRAAM ER on a jet?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think the short answer is anything's possible. It is not something that we're currently doing, but the fact that the missile is developed and the fact that the missile, you know, is going through the testing and the certifications, if at some point in the future there is a desire from a customer to take that now surface-launched AMRAAM ER and make it air launch capable, it's science that will get us there. But there's nothing that prohibits us from doing it other than the fact that we're just not currently developing the ER version to be an air launch solution at this time.
That is mind-blowing that no one has said, hey, can you just make this longer range for us?
I think, again, you know, once it's there, once this, you know, the work is done and it's out there, you know, it becomes a great solution for somebody, yeah, to come in on the backside, you know, to make it. The priorities are limitless. The resources are very limited. And I, you know, it's all about doing that. But I think, you know, I think our air customers are happy and satisfied that we are developing this. We're not waiting. We're developing this solution so that if and when the time is right, they're not starting with a blank sheet of paper and, you know, the testing and the certification and all those things will have been completed. And it will be a more rapid transition than would normally be under the normal acquisition cycle.
Oh, man, I tell you, I get stories for days about, you know, you have a new weapon. So you have a new booster, a new seeker, and all of the thousands of variables that are in play that you're trying to, yeah, account for to get it to a point where it's a dependable, trustable solution that an operator can just hit a button and know to trust it that it's going to work. Man, it is, when you start from scratch, it's a, yeah, long road to get to that way where the operator is going to trust it. So if you could, you know, hey, I have a booster over here from another program and a seeker over here from another program and put them together, those variables, you know, get, you know, exponentially cut. So you can focus on the things that are different, and then, all right, off of my soapbox. But actually, that might actually be a segue into talking about the, yeah, sensors, because I think what you guys are doing is a little bit of that. You're not starting from scratch from this. You have an IRAD project that actually I think you recently got a contract for to help nudge it along a little bit, right? Tell us about the Ghost.
Yeah,
guy.
So, you know, again, a little bit of a history lesson. You know, Raytheon about 3 years ago was down selected to provide the U.S. Army what I would call the next generation Patriot radar. And for a lot of reasons, again, the threats have evolved. You know, the old Patriot was a directional sensor. It was built during the Cold War. We knew where the enemy was. It was the Warsaw Pact. It was the Soviet Union coming across the Fulda Gap. And that's why Patriot was designed to be a directional sensor, using all of the energies of a radar in a specific direction to take on that threat set. Over the last 40 years...
Joe, you did that,
I did,
right?
Yes.
In the Army,
yeah,
you managed that. So you did fan planning?
Yes, that's
right?
Exactly right.
Fan, like it's a wedge of fan planning. Like, which... I got to make sure this fan overlaps with that fan, so there's no gaps, and I can only do this and only do that.
Oh,
so,
you're absolutely right. Yeah. But with the advent of maneuvering threats, and frankly, the battlefield that had changed, you know, we used to have the forward line of troops where the enemy was on one side and we were on the other, and there was this clashing. It became a very asymmetric battle space, and the threat became 360. So directional radars were, you know, were out, and we needed to take that same kind of capability, but be able to provide it in a 360 solution. So Raytheon was awarded the contract for the lower tier air and missile defense sensor, LTAMDS, which most people refer to as the sensor that will replace the Patriot radar and provide that 360 capability for solution sets. The Army's solution is what they call the Army Integrated Air and Missile Defense capability, if you will, which is a combination of the Integrated Battle Command System, C2, the LTAMDS radar, and the PAC-3 MSE missile. That's kind of the cornerstone of the U.S.'s solution. For a lot of Patriot customers, they will take that route. In some cases, they want to keep what they have, and they want to bring this LTAMDS radar into their solution set. But in doing so, what Raytheon did was leveraged our investment, our decades of investments in the most advanced technologies that we put into sensors. Raytheon makes the world's best sensors. We also make, I would like to say, we make the world's best effectors as well, but we do really make the world's best sensors. And using our investments in AESA GAN technology, we were able to produce the LTAMDS radar, which is absolutely phenomenal. As we looked at the LTAMDS solution, the one thing that we wanted to build in was modularity. You know, in other words, can we take this same technology and can we building block it in a way that you can use it for shorter, bigger, smaller, different types of solution sets? So we built that building block approach, and then using software as really the modification that you would, you know, you would be able to develop the new capability with. So essentially, long story short, if you look at an LTAMDS radar, it kind of looks like a Patriot radar with two steering arrays in the back. So you got this big main array, and then you've got two arrays in the back. And essentially, our approach to this was that we needed to have a steering array in order to address the threats that, you know, the military wanted the Patriot solution to do. We took that back array and we said, hey, what if we took this back array with all the capabilities we have, we put it on a rotator, and, you know, what kind of capability would that give us? When we did that, it was eye-opening. And for us, it became the perfect solution for our NASAMS customers who now want to take NASAMS to that next level, if you will. And so we have developed what we call the GhostEye MR, medium ranged. We call them the GhostEye family because, again, it's a building block approach. We can develop unique one-offs based on the base technology of LTAMDS to meet the customer's requirements. But now what we're doing is we are integrating this GhostEye MR capability into the NASAMS solution. And to your point, Mike, you know, recently we had a very successful demonstration that was supported by the U.S. Air Force as part of their.
I'm gonna ask you about that in a minute. Yeah,
yeah.
I read that and I had to read it like three or four times because there's a lot of moving pieces there. But I finally was like, oh, I see what happened.
No, there are. There's a lot. You know, the Air Force is looking at ways. They've got a cruise missile requirement. You know, they're kind of the lead agency for cruise missile defense. They have an air base air defense requirement that you've talked about in the past. They have an expeditionary requirement to go into lands that maybe are not matured and yet establish, you know, some sort of control, surveillance and control of the airspace above them. So, you know, the Air Force was, you know, out looking around, and we were fortunate enough. And oh, by the way, the Air Force is very familiar with NASAMS because a lot of the effectors that are used in NASAMS are effectors that the Air Force uses. And so we have been able to participate with the Air Force and demonstrate for them the capabilities of the NASAMS solution in its current capacity, in its current configuration, but also with the next generation sensors that we have. And we did a demonstration recently that was very successful. I don't like to speak for the Air Force. I mean, they'll be announcing some things in the not too distant future, but we're very excited to work with the Air Force in helping them solve hard problems that they're having to deal with in large part from existing capabilities. So again, you don't have to start with a white sheet. and take 10 years to get there. You know, we have been advancing and developing solutions in a way that we believe the customer needs. Now it's a matter of showing them. And, you know, we look forward to continuing to work and develop some of our solutions to make this work. But this ghost eye variant, if you will, when you think about it, you know how long it takes to build a radar. You know, again, from white sheet to the end, I mean, it could literally take a decade. The LTAMDS radar that Raytheon was contracted by the U.S. Army is already in production and is in testing with the U.S. Army 3 years after contract. 3 years after contract, it is out at White Sands Missile Range under the direction of the U.S. Army acquisition community and executing its intended purpose for fielding in the not-too-distant future. All of the benefits that we're gaining from that just naturally migrate into a solution like the Ghost Eye radar, because the fundamentals are exactly the same. So it's, you know, a dollar spent on LTAMDS, you don't have to spend another dollar on the Ghost Eye. You can leverage that, the lessons learned, the capabilities, the modifications, and that same dollar can be used to develop the solution for an alternative to the LTAMDS radar, which in this case is Ghost Eye. So we're really, really excited. It's going to give our customers an opportunity to truly take NASAMS in directions that 10, 15 years ago, they were limited by capability. We are removing those obstacles, and we are allowing the customer to be able to take it and frankly, to get in front of the threat. You know, we always seem to be chasing the threat. The threat does something. We build something for that threat, and then they build something, and we're always kind of behind it. This LTAMDS and this Ghost Eye investment is literally going to put us in front of the threat so that it can do more than what the current threats are capable of doing, and then keep the lead by continuing to modernize. And again, not a lot of hardware modernization. You know, sensor technologies today, it's really about software. And as you know, software modifications can happen much quicker and much less expensive than actually having to change hardware components, if you will, within the sensor confines of the capability.
Awesome. There's a lot to unpack there. Let me go back to let's talk about the radar just a little bit more. I thought this was very interesting. So we'll see which direction this conversation goes. So Raytheon, obviously you're Raytheon, the MPQ-64 mm-hmm. Sentinel, that's the radar you were talking about before, but there's different versions of it. There's the Sentinel, the A1, A2, A3, and I think where it gets a little weird now is the A4. Yep. Lockheed Martin actually is making that.
That's
now,
correct.
Right? So, and this is the, you know, not to poke the bear, but I think it's both companies are executing a very, very similar strategy in the radar space, this ground-based radar space, but they're executing it backwards. So Lockheed won the Sentinel A4 contract in 2019. It's $300 million, something like that. They took that radar that they had built and then they scaled it up into what they call the TPY-4 radar, and that's what the Air Force is buying as their long-range surveillance radar. So they had a program of record that was small, and they, through modularity, like you mentioned, they're scaling up. You guys won the program of record for the big radar for the Army, and now you're using IRAD to scale it down.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, you know, you have to start from a place, right? And really the place that you start from generally is the program of record. And in Lockheed's case, you know, their program of record was in one place. In ours, our program of record was in another. And then it's from that starting point that you then build your strategy, if you will, to play and to be competitive in a larger market than just the one that you've been the program of record for. Particularly on the global market. You know, the global market, I think, you know, American sensors, I'm not gonna lie, the sensor market's getting very congested globally. There's a lot of international industries out there that are wanting to play in that sensor market space. It's, you know, 20 years ago, the US was the only one that really made good ones. Now There are countries around the globe that have invested and are trying to catch up. So I think, you know, part of our strategies are to retain the advantage we have, the technological advantage, the understanding, and frankly, address the customer's needs, not only from the capability of the hardware that you're building, but how is that more efficient, effective in the larger life cycle, if you will, of a radar or a effector or command and control system. It doesn't really matter. Customers are smart. They know what the cost of the product is. What they want to know is, where else am I going to be able to save resources, time, money, and people? If you build something, yep, but it requires five more people in order for that thing to work, that's a disadvantage in today's market space. You want to say what used to take five people now only takes two. That resonates with the customer. Repair parts, you know, how many? Do you have to have 1,000 repair parts on these things? Or have you been able to leverage, you know, technology to have a much smaller number of repair parts? So you don't have to have them sitting on the bench. You don't have to have that investment. Though that's the larger piece. You know, everybody talks about the sexy capability of the component. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, the storyline that helps the customer see the entire life cycle value of your solution is really a discriminator today more than it's ever been.
Yeah, that's a good point. I won't say what it is, but we'll call it a munition, not a Raytheon one, but so process elimination, but a munition that's fieldable out there. And the Pentagon wanted to scale production. Like, we want to, like, how many can you produce today? Like, we can produce this. Like, great. We want to buy this much. And like, ooh, well, it's going to take us like 3 years to build in the supply chains to do that. And come to find out, like, this one munition had something like 70 subcontractors, and they had, you know, there's tier two, tier three suppliers, and to get all of those people to all change at the same time and coordinate that, all because it wasn't streamlined. Like you said, managing your supply chains is streamlined. And then how do I have, you know, economies of scale? You know, why is this one, you know, the screw, why does the screw have to be this spec when I can just change the spec and make it compatible with four other systems? Well, that's just what the engineer picked.
No,
right?
You're absolutely
like, sometimes
right.
Sometimes there's a reason. Sometimes it's not.
You hit the nail on the head. And those are the types of things, you know, that I think industry in general, again, you saw what Lockheed's doing. You see Raytheon's doing. To your point, we kind of did it from different start points. But the cognitive process that's being used is to address those very things, because that's how competitive the market is. If you're not getting down to that level of fidelity, taking burden off the soldier, off the airmen, taking cost off the acquisition community while adding capability to the work, that's the key to success. And we have to think differently about that, particularly if you're going to play in the global market. Those are the rules. Those are the unwritten rules of global ground-based air defense. And I would imagine it's that way in a lot of the other mission spaces as well. You know, I don't claim to be an expert in those areas, but certainly in ground-based air defense, if you're not thinking that way, you're not going to be around very long.
Speaking of ground-based air defense, are you involved in the Army's indirect fire protection capability system, the IFPC? Are you guys involved?
Yes, we are. We are a subcontractor to Dynetics, who is the prime.
That makes more sense now. Because I saw, so they have Dynetics, which is owned by Leidos.
Yes.
They have their proposal is called Enduring Shield. And I was looking at it, I'm like, that looks kind of like a NASAMS launcher to me. And like, oh, it's shooting AIM-9Xs from the ground. I'm like, that sure sounds like a NASAMS launcher to me.
Yeah.
What parts of that are you guys subbed on for them?
You know, again, as the lead, subcontractors don't like to get in front of their primes, if you will. But we are partnering with.
Right. You are working with them though. I had questions when I saw it said Dynetics. I'm like, that looks very, very similar to the Kongsberg Raytheon NASAMS launchers.
Oh, you know, the indirect protection fire capability path has been a very interesting one, as you know. You know, another thing that we learned in the insurgency, kind of in the GBAD world, was rockets, artillery, and mortars were landing on FOBs all over Iraq and Afghanistan. And frankly, we didn't have anything to protect them with. And so industry, along with the military, again, we surveyed the inventory, and we came up with, we took the Phalanx gun off of a naval ship, put it on a trailer, because the Phalanx gun on a ship was really doing those types of things. It was counter rockets, counter capability. And we created what we call a CRAM capability, counter rocket artillery and mortar, which allowed FOBs, forward operating bases in Iraq and Afghanistan, to not just absorb these rockets, artilleries, and mortars that were coming in, but in certain cases, to be able to actually try to shoot them. Conceptually, it's ground-based air defense, right? You got a threat coming in, you're going to shoot it from the ground. IFPC was kind of like the validation that, hey, listen, in the future, we need to have something that can do this so that we're not caught with our pants down like we were when we went into Iraq post OIF-1. And so that's how IFPC was born, if you will. IFPC as a solution and a capability is kind of morphing now, because yes, there is this rocket, artillery, and mortar, on a fixed FOB kind of defense you have, but cruise missiles are still alive and well everywhere. So how do we expand the mission set? And I think, we're working very closely with the Army customer to help understand what is that new IFPC. You created a requirement years and years ago, but threats are changing. Is there a way that we can absorb these new threats that we have with a capability that we're committed to developing in the future? And that's why it's kind of hard to really understand. Yeah. I look at IFPC as it's wet cement. It's been poured, but we're still kind of forming it. And we're trying to do so in a way that really keeps up with the evolving threats that, that we may want to use that capability for in the future.
Now, the wet cement comment, I think, resonates, because this is the, if I remember right, this IFPC, the Indirect Fire Protection Capability, that effort, like you said, it's morphed. And this is the effort that the Army had bought the first one or two Iron Domes from. And the Iron Dome, it was built for a very, very specific purpose. And it's pretty good at its very, very specific purpose, which was to protect Israel from incoming rockets and mortars.
Right.
And so the difference is rockets and mortars, and the way the entire system works is you detect it, you can compute the ballistic profile, and then you can compute where that thing is going to land. And so the magic of the Iron Dome, it's like, well, if this is going to land in a field and not hit anyone, I'm not going to expend an effector to knock it out. I'm just going to let it land in the field. Who cares? But if it's going to land and it's all like, it's got this mapping system. So if I map that mortar or rocket and I know it's going to like land in this civilian populated center, I will launch an effector to intercept it. That doesn't work if you have a cruise missile.
You don't know where it's going. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically designed to like counter the things that the insurgency and the terrorists from like Hamas can throw at Israel, right? Or really, or maybe from Lebanon too. But it's not a nation on nation like capabilities defense.
No, you're absolutely
right.
That's
where I think the Army started, and they were like, the wet cement. Like, let's pause because this might not actually work for what we need for.
You're absolutely right. And, and I'm familiar with the Iron Dome system. Raytheon works with Rafael on the effector.
Oh, and if I said any of that
wrong. No, I think you hit the nail on the head. My point would be is no different than what, we've been talking about in terms of taking a base capability and being able to modify the base in order to address other things. We're not the only ones that do that. I think if you're going to compete in the global market, you better have a base solution that has the ability to evolve or move into additional spaces to make that happen. And, again, I don't speak for Rafael or the Iron Dome system, but its intended purpose, what it was designed to do, is you hit the nail on the head. And I would also say that I think that there's a pathway for them to kind of say, okay, if we could do this with these new kinds of threats that are happening, how do we expand? How do we change the algorithms? How do we do things to make it effective in other areas that it wasn't initially intended to do? So you got it right. You hit the nail right on the head of cruise missiles. We don't know exactly where those cruise missiles are going to land. So it's hard to it's hard to figure it out. And frankly, and they move. You know, I mean, the biggest challenge with cruise missiles over the last couple of years is, you know, they're just not on a on a normal trajectory. They maneuver, and they maneuver in ways that cause havoc on traditional counter cruise missile solutions. So you have to build in the maneuverability aspects of the threat, you know, when you're going forward today that, you know, 10 years ago, you didn't have to worry about.
We got two more things we want to talk about before we wrap up. We'll talk about Ukraine very as much as we can. And then I want to talk to end on that demo that we had kind of alluded to. There's been a couple demos, not the one that has been done but not released, but we'll talk about one that I think that happened last year. So NASAMS has been deployed to 13 countries. One of them is now Ukraine. It was sent as part of one of the initial aid packages in 2022. And I think people weren't tracking really, most people weren't tracking what NASAMS is or, oh, this system went to Ukraine. But when President Zelensky actually like mentioned it in an attack against the Capitol, and it said it shot down 10 missiles that were coming in. So it was 10 out of 10, 100% PK. And I kind of got people's attention, like, oh, there's a U.S. built air defense system that the U.S. actually doesn't have, but Ukraine does. That's weird.
Yeah. It is weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Sure, there's a lot of inside, there's Pentagon politics in play of why that is or not.
Well,
but to your point, it's not just that, though. Like, and this is where I kind of wanted to talk about it. Like, because this system has been deployed, it's not new, it's mature. Just because the U.S. doesn't have an entire program of record of them, obviously they're in the National Capital Region, but just because the U.S. military doesn't have it as a program of record doesn't mean it's not mature.
Right.
Even though it's U.S. built. So the latest that I saw is that there are roughly two dozen NASAMS launchers in the country, and they have racked up over 100 kills against missiles and drones, and that's as of about 6 months ago. That was my open source reporting. Not trying to get you to confirm or deny any of that, but those are stuff that I did look up. So roughly two dozen launchers in country, 100 plus kills. So that's a remarkable track record.
Yeah. So to your point, Mike, you know, the one thing I take caution by, I never talk about another customer's capabilities and solutions. It's their narrative to communicate, and you know, we're always very respectful of that. That being said, we, along with Kongsberg, you know, our Norwegian partner, have been very focused and invested in assisting our newest customer, Ukraine, in the use of the NASAMS system in a real-world combat conflict, if you will. And so we are learning an immense amount about the system in actual combat operations. To your point, the Ukrainian soldiers, not just with NASAMS, but with every weapons, you'd think they are fighting a war in large part with weapons that they were never trained on and doing so quite admirably. It is remarkable to see that. It also speaks to the ease of some of this, you know, some of the capabilities and solutions that that we're putting out there. So when people ask, you know, like, how hard is it to, you know, to train soldiers to use NASAMS, you know, the truth of the matter is well, you know, look at what's happening in around the world. And, you know, you can kind of draw your own conclusions. But when we tell you it's not hard, it really isn't. So obviously there's going to, you know, it's deployed, you know it. The Ukrainians have said that we are committed, as we are for all of our customers, to ensuring that we are with them when they are using our solutions to execute their duties and missions. We're learning a lot, and we are very proud of the Ukrainian soldiers that are manning the system, and we are very proud of the system and its performance. And I'll kind of leave it at that, Mike.
Yeah, well said, Joe. Well said. Special shout out to Norway and really Kongsberg as well, for stepping up to the plate, because they have not just the U.S. aid package has been providing these NASAMS. A lot of them have actually been flowing from Norway's aid package through Kongsberg. So they just announced, as we're recording this about a week or two ago, eight more NASAMS they've committed to send to Ukraine. So it's not just the U.S. that's delivering these things. It's it's your partner Kongsberg through Norway's aid package. So there's obviously synergies there. The other synergies is because the launchers are in country and the effectors are leveraging existing capabilities. There's over 30 countries that have AIM-120s and AIM-9s. So the huge stockpile that you can pull from for people that may have not normally been in a position to help with air defenses for Ukraine with these launchers in country, like just give me your air-to-air missiles. Like, oh, well, we have those here. Take these and we'll, you know, we'll buy.
No, you're absolutely right.
I think that's it's a very interesting dynamic. And I think this situation in particular shows the value proposition that I think a lot of people have had this conflict not happened. The manifestation of that value proposition would not have happened because people are like, oh, now because I can ask and where you can help and how a coalition, where can a coalition contribute? And you know this from partners and allies in the Middle East, like you have this kind of a matrix of like, who has what do you want to contribute? What can you contribute? This is a way to kind of unlock that coalition. Yeah, special shout out to Norway. Yeah, and obviously Kongsberg and Raytheon.
Norway as a country, as you know, is a very close ally to the United States. And you've mentioned right from the very beginning of this discussion that, you know, Kongsberg and Raytheon's relationship is deep. It's deep, it's long, it's successful. In fact, I was just with them last week meeting to review things at the end of the year to make sure that we were all aligned for, you know, the priorities heading into 2024. NASAMS, as you can imagine, is exploding in opportunity as the word gets out, as people start to see, frankly, as nations start to realize that they have allowed either they don't have an air defense capability or they've allowed their air defenses to atrophy, the need quickly to invest in capabilities that will protect them and their most valuable assets as quickly as possible. You know, we're working hard to help those customers look at what's around the globe and to show them that, in fact, not only the solution that we have today, but customers are interested, like, so what's your growth plan? You know, what are you doing? And, you know, we're very proud and we have a very compelling story when we talk about that, whether it's the advances in the fire direction center with technologies and scopes and human machine interaction, the transition from Sentinel to the Ghost IMR, which, by the way, I'm not sure if I, you know, articulated it correctly enough, but you know, we just concluded an airbase air defense test with Ghost IMR out at White Sands Missile Range with really, really good results. And you're going to see those being announced by the U.S. customer very soon. So we've got that sensor piece. Of course, you know, you've got the effectors. We started with one. We were now up to three. We're listening to the customers and the types of ways that they may want to be using their NASAMS. And so it's not just a pretty PowerPoint slide that kind of shows the thing. We can actually show them that we have in fact been on this modernization plan for a while and join the family of 13, you know, nations who are coming along. You get so much more accomplished, so much more effectively and efficiently if you're part of a family or a community, if you will, of organizations that are committed to that solution set. If you buy into a solution that there's only one or two customers, I mean, you can only spread the cost across one or two customers. You know, but when you buy into a solution that's spread across, you know, a dozen or more, it becomes very manageable, even for countries that don't have a lot of money. And I think that's the real value, you know, the real nice thing that they're starting to see and connect on. And, you know, our job is to continue to invest, to continue to tell the story, to continue to support the warfighters that are using our weapon systems every day. I mean, again, I'm a 30-year warfighter, you know, this industry thing's kind of new to me. I've only been doing it for 9 years, but you know, I still think like a warfighter every day when I come to work. And you know, my job and Raytheon has been wonderful in allowing me to kind of be that representative, if you will, to them, and listening to the ways that a customer looks at a solution. As we talked about earlier, it's not just the shiny object. It's all those other things that have to come together to make that shiny object work in a way that's efficient and effective. And yeah, I've been blessed. I love what I'm doing. I wake up every morning with purpose. And, you know, I'm going to take a couple of days off for Christmas, but I'm going to get right back on in the saddle when 2024 starts. And we've got a lot of opportunities for customers who desperately need strong ground-based air defense capabilities where NASAMS would be a wonderful solution for them. So we're excited.
That would have been the perfect ending of this episode, if not that I said that we were going to ask you about a demo. So that's perfect. So I'm going to screw up the end of this interview by going back and asking you about a demo from last September that had the Air Force, the Army, and then NASAMS, and I think Kongsberg, mm-hmm. because the fire distribution center was from Kongsberg. So this is the one I read a few times, and I'm like, what's going on here? There's all these different moving pieces. Can you just explain? So I'm not going to try to explain it. If you explain it, it would actually make
sure. So I think, you know, the study that we did a while back was really about developing a counter cruise missile solution for the homeland. Because MDA was involved with this as well, in a way that, again, as we've talked about a couple of times, Mike, that doesn't start with a clean sheet. You know, how can you take existing capabilities and then some of the things that we're investing in that are maturing, and can we put those things together in a way that really creates a solution set, if you will? And so we worked with the U.S. Customer with the NASAMS solution set, which included the FDC, it included the missiles that we have, it included the sensors we have. And we also incorporated other capabilities that the U.S. customer has, some C2 capabilities, some of them mature, some of them that were coming on board. And the idea was, can you take this core capability that is recognized around the world, and can we incorporate these other capabilities that we have to create a counter cruise missile capability that's more than what we have today? And so that's what that test was all about. It was, you know, it was a laboratory like environment test, and we were successful. But again, it showed the flexibility. You know, we talk about NASAMS being, you know, open architecture. We talk about it being able to take other matured capabilities that maybe are indigenous that a customer has and incorporate them into the baseline. Our study, the test that we did, was specifically designed to do that. And by all the measurements that went into that evaluation, we were successful. So it gave the U.S. customer more, you know, it validated a pathway that the U.S. customer could consider if, in fact, they want to go down a lane to develop a counter cruise missile capability in the near term, maybe while other solutions are being developed or being more matured and, you know, whatever the case may be. But again, you know, we looked at it. We thought, you know, yes, this is something that we believe, we have designed into our core capability to be able to do. And so that's what we did. And in fact, I think the U.S. customer was very happy with the results.
If I was reading between the lines, because the press release is a little confusing. If I could read between the lines on this, when I think of a surface-to-air missile system, so flipping the terminology, you think of it as a circle. Mm-hmm. So if I fly within that circle, I am in a threat. Well, with the NASAMS and the networked approach in the distribution center, you have multiple launchers, and whether you put them in a line or other some kind of geometric shape, and then based on where the threat is coming from, this system basically says this launcher is in the best position to facilitate that intercept. And oh, by the way, which missile and which launcher, because there are multiple missiles types in the launchers like we talked about earlier, so it's matching weapon to target pairing. And not just a target, but multiple targets. That's where I think the magic is versus like here, I have one system with launchers. There's three things, shoot three missiles and like, let's see what happens. But being able to do that optimal weapon target pairing in a way that optimizes your resources and maximizes your PK, That I think is.
Oh, it is. You hit the nail on the head. And, you know, I'll add one little kind of nugget to that. It's also the ability to address like swarm attacks. You know, there's a lot of solutions out there that they have to, they're kind of sequential, if you will, in their approach. And so, you know, everybody kind of knows a new enemy tactic is to swarm, to kind of try to overwhelm the system, yep. if you will. That NASAM's capability, in large part because of the things that you just talked about, I'm not going to talk on this number, but the number of simultaneous engagements that can occur is quite impressive. And that has to do with the C2, the sensor, and the effectors, and then the network that it operates in. It's those four things that allow a very, very impressive simultaneous engagement capability that I'm not aware of exists even remote anywhere else in that market space, if you will.
Well said. Well, Joe, I think we're about out of time. It was great to talk to you. It's a little frustrating to hear that the most combat proven U.S. built air-based air defense system is not in the hands of the U.S. military yet, even though it's been battle tested for a couple of years. But we'll get there. Maybe we'll get there. But Joe, thanks for taking your time today. Really do appreciate it. Where can people find you and learn more about NASAM?
Yeah, so what I would encourage you to do is get on to the RTX website. RTX is our, you know, is the business, the corporation with which Raytheon operates, or at Raytheon.com. Type in NASAMs, and you can go ahead and get involved. Of course, if you're a customer, your audience is generally comprised of uniformed people and government employees. Joe D'Antona, joseph.dantona@rtx.com. Send me a note. I'd be happy to talk with you and provide any follow-on information that you might desire to have.
I appreciate it, Joe. We'll put a link to the website and your email in the show notes, knowing that that's probably you might get some spam.
That's right.
I'll think about that. We may or may not put that in the show notes.
I'll leave it to you. You're the expert.
All right. Well, for our listeners, you know the deal. Like, follow, subscribe, leave us a rating and a review on your platform of choice. That's the show. Thanks for being here. See ya.